The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And this is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio with Donal Kavanagh here on till 12 midday. Just a few of your comments before we go any further. Donal, your guest's comments about what the Taoiseach said around Israel's right to defend itself was not strictly correct. Varadkar did caveat his comment with, but Israel doesn't have the right to do wrong. There's an excellent opinion piece in yesterday's UK Guardian outlining Ireland's criticism of Israel, thus making it an outlier in the EU where Israel is concerned. That's a long-held position. Your guests would do well to read this article to see where their elected politicians stand against Israel. And that comes from one of our callers there. We have a comment that says, and we were discussing the perception that young people are responsible for a lot of antisocial behaviour. Just look at what happened in Carndonagh on Halloween night, turning over of vans and petrol bombings and fires being set, so says the caller. And indeed, yes, that topic was discussed on the programme earlier this week. Donegal Dunlingal translates as Fort of the Foreigners, the caller says. To me, that was long ago, but it's an appalling vista for our Irishness if all our young people are planning to emigrate. Like your young panel, we have a population of great young people and our government must change policies to provide conditions for a sustainable future so that we can retain our well-educated, articulate young people to improve the country into the future. I worked all my life to try to make our country a great place for our children and grandchildren's futures. Our Irish culture is worth fighting for, so says a caller. Now, one or two requests, actually, just to get through. Congratulations to Mum Anne-Marie Kelly on her first class honours degree, and that's with love from her wee man Dahi. And also to Mammy Donna Gamble, congratulations on her first class honours degree, and that's from son Tyler. So congratulations indeed, Anne-Marie and Donna. I know it's no easy thing getting a degree while raising a family at the same time, and doubly so, I suspect. If I did it myself years back with the Open University, but I presume it's doubly difficult when you're a mammy. And please play a request for my daughter Zara Lynch of Galdena, wishing her a very happy 23rd birthday, and also congratulations on graduating from the ATU in Letterkenny yesterday. Lots of love from very proud mum Tina and sisters Sky, Lily and brother Jed. And that's from Tina, and we absolutely echo that. Congratulations and happy birthday to you, Zara. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio, and it's a Friday morning. It's 18 minutes past 10. It's time for our legal discussion, and we're joined, I'm glad to say, by Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company, Letterkenny and Remelton, taking your legal questions and discussing some of the legal issues of the day. Seamus, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Donal.
Absolutely, it's great to speak to you, Seamus, as ever. Seamus, a lot of people will be looking with interest at the Corbett case in the US and what is a sentencing hearing. Now, it seems to me that, I mean, a sentencing hearing one might have expected will take a day and will have a victim impact statement and perhaps some other submissions, and then sentence will be passed. This appears to be even almost more detailed than a trial, what's happening here.
Yes, it is. And it has certainly captured, well, the media, nearly the world media at this stage. You're quite right when you said about how a sentencing a procedure would go ahead in this jurisdiction on this side of the pond. You would likely have victim impact reports, and maybe probation service might have an input. But yes, you could, but they certainly could go into a couple of days. But this has taken on and like a mini trial, actually. And what I think from an observer, it's interesting, and I'm a little bit uneasy about the fact that Jason Corbett, the deceased, it's as if his life has now been looked at and that he's been put on trial to some degree, bringing up the aspects of his life with one of the accused, his wife, that is obviously on trial with her father for his death. But they have certainly shone a torch into their relationship, with a view to mitigation, I believe. That is the thrust of it. And you can understand that type of tactic. Whether or not it would happen in that detail over here, I think that is slightly open to question. But there's been some sensational stuff being brought out in the last within the last couple of days. And only yesterday, there was a pathologist was questioning the cause of death of Jason Corbett's first wife, which was back a number of years ago. And they even went into the post-mortem and that, and the pathologist's report. And he concluded that there was no actual cause of death really noted in that. And in the course of that, he was asked about whether or not it was claimed that she died as a result of an asthma attack. Yeah. You might remember that. And he was of the view that, no, that wasn't the case. Now, he's actually a prosecution witness that was brought in to rebut pathologists that are going to be brought in for the defendants in advance, as it were. But he resigned from that, from the asthma point, and he was asked, would it be possible that it could have been strangulation? And he agreed to that. But then he quickly, I think, made the point that he did not agree that there was a strangulation attempt on Jason Corbett's wife on the night in question. So that in itself is extraordinary, that even would be brought into this, because that was events long since passed. It's adding emphasis to this point of the type of individual that they're trying to portray. And they follow that in quickly then with the second prong, which is the evidence of the children. And this is the whole reason why there has been a retrial, because within a couple of days after the event in 2015, which unfortunately resulted in Jason Corbett losing his life as a result of hit with baseball bats and a brick, the children were interviewed then when they were in the custody of their mother, their stepmother, and her mother. And then at that point, they give evidence, and it was recorded, it was recorded in one of these advocacy centres for children, that there was they gave a lot of details of domestic incidents, and allegations of domestic abuse, maybe. And whether they went as far as violence, there's certainly very, very large hints of that in that. And then they went back to Ireland, and that's very important, because they rescinded those statements in Ireland when they went back over to the Corbett family. And they did so again then in 2021 when there was a retrial ordered. But those statements were excluded from the trial, which resulted in the convictions of his wife and her father, Tom Martins, for the second-degree murder charges, for which they were, I think they got the sentences of around 25 years each. Now, they've also at the moment done 23 and a half years each, which will be very relevant and pertinent when this sentencing hearing concludes as to what type of sentence is now going to be introduced for the manslaughter pleas.
In terms of the children's evidence, is there a legal precedent to now effectively allow what were rescinded statements and excluded statements to be reintroduced? Because the big question mark now becomes, were those first statements the truth, and were the children effectively, as is being claimed or inferred, coached by the Corbett family once they got back to Limerick? So the claim, then the counterclaim could well be that they were coached initially by the Martins as to what to say in the initial interview. Now the claim is they were coached by somebody else. There is some talk of perhaps the children speaking directly at this sentence hearing. Do you think that is going to happen?
I think that they are torn, obviously, between a rock and a hard place. I feel that at the time of their lives, it's now 8 years ago. Sarah, the daughter, was aged eight, so now brings her 16, and Jack was aged 10. I do believe, if you stand back from this, that they are the victims of this, because they're obviously torn between two sides. The claim about the coaching, just going back to the point you're making about the evidence being brought in, the point there was that with the defence were obstructed in putting up a full defence by the exclusion of those statements, because that gave them an avenue to attack the prosecution. And the credibility of those statements could have been teased out, as it were, at the particular hearing in the first instance, if they were allowed in. And then the defence could have used them, and it would be up to a jury then to decide on the facts. The coaching point, I think, that you make is quite valid to make that. But if that is the case, then it would, as it were, cut both ways. In that, if you make the claim that there could have been coaching immediately thereafter the event in 2015, within 2 to 6 days, and indeed then I think there was video evidence taken of the statements, well, then you could make the same point whenever they went back to Ireland, that it cuts either way. So I don't think you can add, well, I wouldn't add an awful lot of weight to that. I think that initially, though, at the trial and the second degree murder trials that took place, that at that point they should have been allowed in and teased out then about them being rescinded and the recantation. Now, there's going to be evidence given, I believe, about how they recanted from those statements later on. Whether or not the children will go into evidence, as I said, they're now 16 and 18, and their lives have to move on. And I would be concerned as to how they come out of this and how this would impact on them. Yeah. And I think there should be serious consideration given to that.
We were speaking earlier about the evidence with regards to the pathology reports and the post-mortem. And there's one headline in the papers this morning. Manslaughter case hears Jason Corbett's first wife did not die from asthma attack. Is it the case that the case heard that she didn't die of an asthma attack, or was the evidence that there was no evidence to say that she died of an asthma attack and asthma was still a possibility? Because reading through the actual body of the evidence, the limited reading I've been able to do, it seems to me that the pathologist wasn't so much denying that it was asthma as saying there is no evidence either way.
Yeah, no, I think that's not an unreasonable assessment of it. I think what you have highlighted is the manner in which a headline can be taken out of context and put up front, which is something that I have never agreed with, but that's often and is what grabs the attention, because the attention span of individuals is so short nowadays, and that's just the way the world has moved on. So that's the headline. That is the headline. But when you look at what he actually said, and then it was teased out about, was it possible that it could be, could it have been strangulation from his reading of it? Well, he said it's possible. Yeah, it's possible. But the reason he was ruling out asthma, and I'm no medic, was to do with the lungs and the air in the lungs itself. And he thought that there should have been shown an inflation of the lungs if it was an asthma death. And therefore, he concluded that it didn't really give an accurate cause of death at all. But as I said before, though, he ruled out the attempted strangulation point that the defence are trying to come up with in relation to the night in question, when unfortunately the deceased was, it's alleged, caught Molly Martins or by the neck, and that they're making a claim that it was an attempted strangulation, which then the self-defense defense rolls in then by saying, well, as a result of that, they have to defend themselves. And then hence the father comes in with the baseball bat. And also, very interestingly, I just find this strange, how you would have a brick in your bedroom, you know, and they said it was from the garden or whatever, and they were going to paint it. It's peculiar, that. And in the meantime, you have Tom Martin's wife, who heard the commotion, and she goes back to sleep. Mm. You know, those are just, you know, when you try to measure it up, and you just would wonder about that as well. So it's definitely not over yet.
Yeah.
But the judge is a very difficult task to take all these matters into consideration. And the other point, though, which is interesting, there is if he finds that there's aggravating circumstances, if he finds that, well, then the sentence can go up to, I think, about max nearly of 9 years, 6 to 9 years in that bracket. But if it's in the very lower bracket, which the way it's running at the moment could very well be, it could be maybe less than 3 or 3 years. And then the point is that they've already served that time, so they could walk free.
And there is, I won't say a presumption, but there is an expectation in many quarters that may well be what happens. I mean, where we stand at the moment is that they have effectively, Molly Martins Corbett and Jack Martins, her father, have pleaded guilty to manslaughter, a lesser charge, obviously, than the second degree murder conviction that they initially had. And the whole point of this whole 2 weeks is to minimise their sentence, because she's claiming she was in fear and she's trying to establish that she had reason to be in fear. And that's why, as you said at the offset, effectively what this is really is a trial of a dead man who can't defend himself.
Yeah, and the defence has the advantage in that they are putting this forward on the basis of mitigation, and they're also bringing back in the self-defence point, and they're bringing in the testimony of the children, all in mitigation. So, as it were, the emphasis is with them and on them. It's up to them, to the prosecution, to rebut that But the defence, to some degree, is in the driving seat as far as the mitigation goes. And that's why it's been framed in this particular way. But it's definitely not over yet. But you could find a situation where on balance and on the hearings that they might have served their time, or there might be some probationary period following. Wait and see.
We will wait with interest. Let's move on to some of the questions that have come in to us. One we've got that's an interesting one. Caller says, I fell down some stairs and landed awkwardly. Within 2 days, I had to give in and get an X-ray. I was told I'd pulled muscles on a rotator cuff. I was told to take pain relief. I was still working as a home care assistant. Pain was unreal and mobility was minimal. I was due to fly out to Australia, so I couldn't really take sick and annual leave in a short space of time. My shoulder clicked while I was at work. My shoulder freed up a little with a pop and pain. I went to Australia on holiday and went to a chiropractor while there, only to discover my shoulder was dislocated. Now, the hospital in Letterkenny has sent me a bill for €100 for the X-ray, which I didn't pay, as my doctor had emailed my details to the emergency department. They said they had no record of this, and now it's been passed on to a debt collection agency. The pain I was in was due to the fall, but how was the dislocation missed in the X-ray? Should I make a written complaint, or am I wasting my time?
Well, it is interesting. I think there's two aspects of it, and I'm not going to recommend someone makes complaints. We don't do that. We have never done that over the years on the show. In regard to that aspect of it, there is a procedure, and they can look it up online. And it's a very thorough complaints procedure within the HSE and the process that you adopt. But the essence, though, of the question is firstly that there's an account for €100 in relation to an X-ray, and that's a bill. If the X-ray was carried out, that's the account in relation to that, and that's the charge that's applicable to it. Now, if you're then making the argument, the second part, that, well, there was an X-ray, but they didn't pick up on the dislocation of the shoulder, then we're probably looking and we're teasing out more like, well, what has been the consequences of that for the individual? And has there been any lasting effect? And are we looking down a type of a medical negligence type of claim? Or does that give rise to it? Well, not on the basis of the way that the way that it's framed the question, because it seems that it's more a complaint about them actually not spotting the dislocation at the X-ray level, but that it should now made a full recovery from it. So that's where if she's going down the route of looking into potential negligence, then she's going to have to probably go along and get an independent opinion by a suitably qualified person in that line, such as a radiologist, to give a view, read that X-ray, and see, well, it should have spotted this, and then a certain action should have taken place. And then, if that happens, it's quite likely, though, that the bill would be written off or wiped out. In the way that it stands, I would think that it would, if you're applying a little bit of give and take, that it should be resolvable. Whether you have to, he or she has to go to the trouble of making a formal complaint, that's a matter for themselves to decide. Does it go as far as medical negligence on the face of what's there? Maybe not, but certainly they could get if they want to invest on an opinion from a radiologist, they could do so, and there would be a cost involved in that. And in my view, finally, that will far exceed the €100.
Caller asks, what rights do a non-custodial parent have to access their child's education achievements and activities and to their medical situation?
Yeah, that's an interesting question too, because it brings in guardianship. The main legislation on that up to, I think, 2015 or 16 was the Guardianship of Infants Act 1964. So the caller is obviously some type of a dilemma. And the first point, that the main point really as well to keep in mind in relation to this, that if a matter has to go before a court to make decisions that can't be worked out between couples themselves, and this is a situation where they're saying non-custodial parent. Well, it's more relevant as that a non-guardian parent, I think, is more the point. But in relation to this, if the matter has to go before a district court on the basis of an application for access, it will be the welfare of the child that will be paramount. And the decision will be taken in the best interest of the child. And the circumstances of the individuals will then will be looked at and a decision made on that basis, on that basis alone. It will not be made on the basis of any parent's real opinion of the matter, but it'll be what is best for the child. Now, if under the Guardianship of Infants Act, and it was reformed in the Family Relations Act in 2015, it has set out the basis for the relationship between the parents. If the child is born outside of wedlock, the mother is the automatic, she's the automatic guardian of the child and has custody of it. Now, thereafter, that may change if she's cohabiting and has been cohabiting for a while. Then the other partner, the father, may certainly be entitled as well to joint guardianship in the circumstances. So that would have to be looked at, the entire circumstances. But the mother, I'm assuming this for the purpose of the question, being because the party's writing it as a non-custodial parent, that this is a child that the mother has custody of. Now, if we look at it and go back to what I've said initially, for dealing with what's in the best interest of the child, if the couple consider that, you know, they both parties should have access to education, achievements and medical situation and making basic decisions. Well, what I would suggest then is that they should both be co-guardians of the child. And they can do that by agreement under that latest piece of legislation, if they so wish. But if it's not by agreement, the father could make an application to the court to be appointed joint guardian. Now, that's an option, and then it would be up to the court to decide on whether that's appropriate. Once there would be a joint guardian situation, well, that changes everything, because if they're a joint guardian, then they would be entitled to this type of information. And I would be of the view that that would be entitled to that automatically. But if they're not a joint guardian, that's where the dilemma is. And this is where, in any of these situations, I've said it over many years on the show, and these matters come up, that the parents have to stand back, act responsibly and act in the best interest of the child, regardless of even what their own relationship is. And usually they won't go far wrong when they do that. And if one of them is showing a big interest in the child and wants to continue with that, well, then maybe a joint guardianship is the way forward. It's entirely up to them. But always consider whatever is best for the child. And I think they'll be on the right path then. I'm always reluctant about family law courts imposing decisions on families. It can be a difficult structure for parents to follow, and it can be difficult for the children. And it is the right of the child that's being protected here, and that's fundamental.
Caller is asking, can I get a copy of my grandmother's will?
Well, you should, or the caller should, approach whomever the executor is of the will. That would be certainly at their discretion. In family situations, it's often good for relationships that, yes, these things are open, but technically speaking, it's an executor's decision. And if the caller is not a person of interest in the will, has not been left a bequest in the will, well, in that situation, the executor is quite within, or executors are quite within their rights to decline that. That's entirely a matter for themselves, but that is the type of authority that they do have. That should be kept in mind. Now, if they've been left a bequest, and this often happens as well, if they have been left something in the will and they want access to it, they're not automatically entitled to a copy of the entire will. They're entitled to a copy of the section of it that's relevant to them, that recites the bequest to them. So that should be borne in mind. And then if it goes further down the line, and if that will is admitted to probate, well then, in that situation, they could apply to the official district probate registry office seeking a copy of it. But that would be further on.
Yeah.
But initially, it would be up to the executors to make the decision.
Now, I mean, and I'm interested in this because the Sunday paper I read very often on page 2, you'll see a little column down on the side that will say Dublin farmer leaves 2.7 million, Meath business person leaves 3 million, Waterford publican leaves 2.6 million. And they effectively will list the details of the amount of money left in people's wills. And now they don't go into any details of where the money goes, but they actually obviously have access to it. So is it a matter that once the will is put into probate and fully put through, it then becomes a public document and anyone can see it?
Yeah, you can apply for a sealed and certified copy of a probate or letters of administration to the District Probate Registry Office or the relevant department of the High Court and take that up. And often the papers, the media do have an interest in that, and the one of which you refer to do that quite regularly and assess them for that purpose. They consider it might be in the public interest, might be in local interest or whatever, what people left. It wouldn't interest me a lot, but I mean, that's maybe what sells papers.
Interesting one here. And now it does refer to another jurisdiction rather than our own, and that possibly will be a factor. Does a pedestrian crossing lose its legal status if the parallel black and white lines are changed? In Derry, the black and white lines have been changed to rainbow colours on one crossing. I think it's quite close to the Peace Bridge there opposite the Guildhall, if I'm correct. I think the legal definition of a pedestrian crossing states that the lines are alternating black and white. If those colours are changed, does that change the legal status of the crossing?
Yeah, it's certainly a good, it's an interesting question. It's broad enough. The rainbow crossing, whether that has effect or legal effect. The point I think that is relevant in relation to the actual legal side of it is usually this will be set by the general bylaws and the city bylaws in respect of the colours of pedestrian crossings. They're generally, because of the old traditions, they were called zebra crossings. If I remember, they were black and white, and that was. But in more modern times, and times have certainly moved on. And I know that recently there was a report in London where the mayor was endorsing multi-colored or rainbow type or colors on a crossing, and I think it was there was some objection from the those who were suffering from being visibly impaired in some way, and it got some slack about that, but. As far as the legal efficacy of them was concerned with the colours, it did not seem to raise an issue at all. The whole point about it is the visibility.
Yeah.
And that's the purpose of it. And it's for the safety of pedestrians. So whether bylaws have to be changed for it or not, you'd have to get on to the relevant local authorities and indeed the Derry local council, whatever, to see what the position is there. Do they lose their legal effect because they're a different colour? In my view, I don't believe they do. I think it's happening all over the world.
Interesting question from a caller. I was given a speeding ticket by a speed van that was parked on a private property which has a sign up saying no parking on this property. Is this ticket valid considering the circumstances in which the van was parked?
Well, everybody, Donald, has the right to a defence in these matters. You'd be issued with a fixed charge penalty notice to pay the fine, accept points, or go the other route, let your period expire and let a further period of whatever, say 30 days expire, and then the fine has gone up, and then you could be issued with a summons, and then you can test the evidence. So that's where what you're looking at, and you have to also work out, is it worth the risk of that? Is it worth the penalty increase to the 5, maybe then the 3? And the cost, if you want to employ a solicitor to test that out. The net point that they're making is in relation to the Go, I think the Go Safe vans themselves. Now, in recent times, whenever you started to see them a lot more on the roads, etc., in or around, there was in 2016, the road traffic, there was a road traffic parking amendment that came in then, and there were certain exemptions given to Go Safe vans, and this is one of them. So I don't think that you're going to be able to play that drum all the way, but I mean, it certainly could be teased out in a court. I haven't seen it yet, but it's likely to have occurred. Will it fly? Is the person prepared to invest money in it and the cost of it? That's up to themselves. But there is certain exemptions for GoSafe vans and where they're parking. And the point they will be making is this, that is, they are targeting the public road. They're not targeting anything else. So it's traffic on the public road and their access to it, which they have to have, and for obvious reasons. And it has been very successful. Now, it sticks in everybody's craw, and I'm not excluded from that, that at times you come across them and it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, you just nearly cannot but be, you know, maybe above it or slightly above it, or they're sort of half concealed and you don't have access to them. I think that's terribly unfair. And I've often thought, well, you know, if the person is caught in those circumstances, that maybe they should challenge it. But technically speaking, if they're over the limit and they're within that zone and they're 10%, I think they have a little bit of discretion, about 10% or so, well, then you're likely to get a ticket and proceed by way of summons and put up the defence. Where they're located at times, I think it brings a lot of chagrin to a lot of people.
One final question before we go. I recently had a personal injury claim settled, but I felt pressurising into settling it. I'm not sure my solicitor was looking out for my best intentions. Can I appeal?
Well, I would be of the view that solicitors are always looking out for their clients' best intentions. And that's the way they operate. Personal injury cases, people do need advice on them. But since the Personal Injury Assessment Board, PIAB, as it was called, once it came in about a decade ago. Now, the individual can lodge the personal injury claim themselves and pursue it in that manner and decide whether they want to accept an assessment or if the case, if they decline to assess it and issue an authorisation, then at that point consult a solicitor to go forward with their case. So this is a situation which obviously has moved on. I would not recommend that people deal with personal injury claims themselves. I think that they're disadvantaged. They're dealing directly with insurance companies, and the objectivity that they need, I think, can be given to them and provided by the legal profession, and have done for generations. And it has always worked. So if a person has settled a case, it means they've settled it out of court. They would have been likely told and properly advised as to the settlement, as to the terms of the settlement, and the sign off on that. The proceedings then are struck out, by the way, and that's the end of the matter. So they're asking about an appeal. I don't see any appeal. If there was an allegation that they weren't properly advised, that's an entirely separate matter, and they'd have to get advice on that independently. But on the face of it, if they're advised and they know exactly what they're signing up to, it shouldn't give rise to a difficulty later on. It's a matter that they should probably tease out with their representatives. And if they want further advice on it, they'd probably have to go elsewhere.
Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn, Solicitors, Letterkenny, Andrew Milton, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you, Donald.
Thank you, Seamus. Now, we're going to look at one or two of your comments before going to our next guest. Some good news for a change about Carndonagh. Caller says, one of Ireland's great rugby players, Bundy Aki, called into Kelly's service station yesterday and had photos taken with the staff. What a lovely man. Many young people enjoy the crack but avoid going out at Halloween because they know the carry-on. That's the comment of one of our callers. Another caller says, drugs are a big problem in many communities, and that is true. And sadly, Donegal not immune for that. Now, are you interested in bridge? Are you a bridge player? Do you play the cards? Because if you do, you may be interested to know that the 46th Donegal International Bridge Conference is taking place this weekend in the Abbey and Central Hotels in Donegal Town. It gets underway this evening at 7:30. Joined on the line by Jim O'Sullivan, who is the Secretary of Donegal Bridge Congress. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Donald. How are you?
Very well indeed, thank you. Jim, a big weekend for Donegal Town, a big weekend indeed for the conference in Donegal.
Very much so, and there's a history and tradition there which I'm very glad is continuing. Obviously, even though it's just a social thing, COVID affected us as well. So for 2 years we ran it in a virtual way, which meant people played from home on computer. But we're back now last year and again this year, hoping to, you know, keep the ship sailing and all the rest of it. Some traditions are worthwhile, I hope, to maintain.
Absolutely. And bridge is a very social game. Now, I'm sure the competition at the tables will be fierce, but no doubt the players know each other. And, you know, people will come from around and they don't see each other from one end of the year to the next. So I'm sure there's going to be a huge social element to this, as well as a huge competitive element.
You've got it spot on there, and that's very much, and again, I know we shouldn't believe our own publicity, but the Donegal Bridge Congress is synonymous with being social. I'm not trying to run down other congresses, but over the years, other congresses have, as it were, moved away from the social side. They've stopped having a, say, a dance on a Saturday night and that kind of thing, and concentrated on the playing. But in the playing, there is tremendous social interaction. I'm not from Donegal. I'm from down in Cork. But because I've been involved with Bridge in Donegal, I've made so many friends and contacts throughout the county. It's been wonderful for me. And I hope I haven't bored people too much. But you said it. It's a social thing, but it's also very competitive. And every now and then, a person can kind of lose the run of themselves and maybe be a little bit rude with their partner. No. Terrible thing to happen, of course.
Of course, and I'm sure as well. I mean, good competitive bridge players want to play against the best. And whereas I'm sure there's great games locally when bridge games take place regularly in Donegal town, I'm sure the big players in Donegal want to play against the big players from the neighbouring counties and further afield.
Well, you just mentioned Bundy Aki being up in Carndonagh. It's the same thing in bridge, maybe in a smaller way, but you get a chance to play against somebody who's represented Ireland. Oh, there's one or two in Donegal have done that. But obviously, the population is such that you have more chance of meeting, expert players who come down from Dublin and other big urban centres to play in Donegal. And we'll be delighted to meet them and maybe show that we can play too, you know.
And presumably you will get some people will come year after year, others will come once in a while. And I'm sure too that, I mean, many of the people, names will come through in the registration process, and you look and go, oh, I recognise that name. The national bridge community, I'm sure, is a relatively small one to the extent that the top players are going to be known right across the country.
Exactly. But, we have a few as well, and there's a man now, he was here last year. He may be unable to come this year, but he's a world bridge champion. He's from Glenswilly. Pat McDivitt is his name. So, you know, we do fly the flag ourselves. There are various gradings in bridge. I don't want to make it too technical, but there's grading from expert world master to novice. And you can guess where a person starts when they start to play. If they decide to play bridge within the confines of the Contract Bridge Administration. There's a Contract Bridge Administration in Dublin, there's one in Belfast, and then there's one in all the various countries. But anyway, our best, as it were, labelled bridge player, he won't mind me mentioning his name, I'm sure, is Conall McLoone from Glenties. Now, he's a life master, and he won't mind me saying he's a bit to go to become the next level, grandmaster, but he's certainly heading that way, you know. So we have our own experts as well. But to go back to your question, yes, it's delightful to interact with these well-known and very good players. And most of them have the manners to help you along and maybe make a suggestion as to how oneself can. And if anybody's interested in going down to Donegal Town and playing, you can play in various grades or you can play in an open. So if you're playing in various grades, you have already been given a grade by the association and you play within the confines of that grade or higher if you want to. Or else you just play in an open competition with people of all kinds.
Caller says...
Call coming through.
A caller has just said, the only time bridge is social is when the game is over. Total silence when games are in progress. And I'm sure that's the case. I mean, I'm sure there is absolute respect at the table. But have the respect of the table, then go for a pint afterwards.
Yeah, I'd like to think that caller it might be right, say, 5% of the time. I hope most of us can afford to laugh at ourselves, our own foolishness. I have a friend I play with, and I tell him when I'm playing with him that I'm bringing a bucket of water with me. Because if he starts, I said, I'm going to throw the bucket of water over you. But that's in jest, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the
it's a game that's based. It grew out of whist and solo. Yeah. I mean, Donegal is.
No, have we lost?
You need four people, and if you're playing at home among four people yourself, that would be called rubber bridge. But most bridge now is more competitive, and it's contract bridge,
where
you play in a club or you play online, and your score is measured against the scores of all the other people who played that particular deck of cards. There's no joker used. Each person starts with 13 cards each. Each person evaluates what she or he feels the hand is worth bearing in mind they have a partner as well. That's where it differs from solo and wisdom then.
Yeah, I'm not a player. My mother-in-law is actually, but I'm not a player myself, and I know very little about it. I know there's bids and there's east, west, north, and south. That's about as much as I know about
east,
bridge.
West, but. East, west, north, south is simply an easy way of deciding who'd sit where at the table. It doesn't have any geographical impact. Yeah. And by the way, if I could get a plug in, there's 14 clubs around Donegal. Anybody who's half interested in saying, Danny, what's it like? If they Google, say they're living in Buncrana, they Google Buncrana Bridge Club, something will come up similar with Glenties or whatever, or Killybegs or Letterkenny or Belfast and all, or try to get them all in, Clonmany and whatever. And it is very social, believe me.
Jim O'Sullivan, the 46th Donegal International Bridge Conference gets underway this evening at the Abbey and Central Hotels in Donegal Town. Thanks very much indeed for speaking to us, and we wish you all the best for the event. Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.